This meeting is being live streamed. This is Value After Hours. I am Tobias Carlyle, joined by my co-host Jake Taylor. As always, our special guest today, the inimitable Eric Cinnamond. How are you, sir?
Welcome, Eric. Good to have you on.
Great. Thanks for having me. You know, we talked before this show, and I think we've already blown through all the A material. So, welcome to Toby's B-side.
So, Eric, just for folks who don't know you, you're with it's your firm, or you're one of three co-founders. I'm going to say Palm Valley Capital Management. Have I got that right?
Palm Valley Capital Management, and I co-manage a small cap portfolio. It's absolute return focused, and the co-manager with me is Jamie Wiggins, a very bright analyst manager, and our other founder is Frank Martin. He's sort of the godfather of absolute return investing. He helped finance us and get us started in 2018. So there's three of us. You know, there might only be three of us left on this planet that run money this way. So you know, we're hanging tight, holding on, and so far so good. We're surviving.
Can you explain, Eric, what the difference is between absolute return approach and a relative return approach?
Yeah, you know, absolute for us is an attractive return over a full market cycle. You know, and we discount our cash flows and our valuations at 10 to 15%. So, you know, when people ask, what does that mean? It means we're trying to achieve our objective on each equity idea we purchase, which is 10 to 15%. And historically, we've done that, you know, in our equities. But what's very different about this strategy is we can hold cash when valuations are expensive and don't make sense, and we can't achieve that absolute return objective on the equities. So cash can fluctuate from being fully invested to, you know, we've been as high as 90% or so. And right now we're in one of those periods where we have quite a bit of cash. So relative return investing, of course, is you're just thinking about the benchmark. I'm trying to keep up. I'm trying not to look too different. You want to beat the benchmark, of course, but you can't look too different. You might get fired, you know. So it's a relative return investing is a little tricky. You know, you can lose 30% and still look good relatively. And that, for us, and a lot of our clients, you know, that they have no interest in that, you know, being down quite a bit, but being a benchmark, that doesn't pay the bill, so to speak. So, yeah, it's really different. You know, this is how money was run in the old days. You know, you find value, you buy it, and when you don't, you don't. It's very common sense tilt. But, yeah, I think, you know, all the passive investing right now, you know, the relative return, I think, is definitely the majority of how most assets are allocated these days.
What's your bogey? What's your return bogey for putting something on?
You know, we use the S&P 600, but, you know, you could look at, I guess, all the small cap benchmarks, the Russell 2000, Russell 2000 Value. They're all kind of similar since inception of the strategy. So, but we don't spend too much time on it. We're required to have a benchmark, but it's not something we really pay too much attention to.
I mean, more in terms of like, what's the
internal hurdle?
Yeah, what sort of return do you need before you'll think about putting it on?
The absolute return?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's at 10 to 15% annually on the equities. Yep. You know, since this strategy, or since the fund, I mean, the strategy has been around for a while, but the fund itself was launched in April 19, and we generated 7.5 after fees, which is a little better than the Russell, about the same as the S&P 600. But, you know, the equities, because we've only been about 20% invested over that time, the equities have returned over 20% annually since inception. So the equities have done very well. So we're really happy about that. Just we're happy about being able to keep up with the market without risking that much capital. So again, we'll have our 5-year in April. So, you know, we're hanging in there. We're obviously how we're positioned as of last disclosure. You know, we're not gonna be up 20-30% this year unless prices get a lot more interesting, you know, anything like that, or you know, even hitting our equity required rates of return on the portfolio, that will be tough because of all the cash. So the cash can bring down our returns over time, but the equity performance can do quite well because we're not being forced to be fully invested. We're not being forced to overpay. And that often, for us anyways, enhances the equity returns.
Yeah, it's fairly astonishing to me, actually, that given this time period that you've been operating in, and to be beating a fully invested benchmark, is it speaks to the the good things that can happen with an opportunistic mindset.
Yeah, and it takes years. You look at certain periods and we'll look really, really stupid, and then there'll be certain periods where we'll look, very smart. But overall, we just want to look, relatively intelligent over a whole full cycle. But the tracking error is insane. So you have to have the stomach for the relative tracking error or the underperformance. There'll be certain periods where we underperform by so much that it can make a lot of professional allocators nervous. So we don't tend to get a lot of business from the institutional consultants because they're very focused relative, but we do get more business with sort of an advisor that has a private client that may have sold their business and they just can't afford to lose 30% because they're 65 years old and they can't do it again. So we talked earlier, we're nice, like a sliver strategy, usually not a core strategy. Where you keep all your assets for kind of a satellite sliver that provides lower correlation to the benchmarks and hopefully, again, a nice return over a cycle.
I read through some of your commentary and some of your blog posts. You say that there was a, and you've invested through this whole period, through the late 1990s, early 2000s, most recent period. You said that you feel like the market changed quite dramatically post 2008 when the Fed bailed out Wall Street in its entirety. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, before 2008, 2009, quantitative easing just wasn't a thing.
Other than
You
in
didn't
Japan,
monetize your debt.
Japanese
It
debt.
just was, it was something taboo. And here we are with the Fed's balance sheet over $7 trillion. And when we started, Toby, you talked about this earlier. I think we were about 800, 900 billion. So yeah, before the rules have changed, where the government could come in and buy debt. So that's very different. And if you look at really 2008 to now, a large portion of the returns in the stock market are for multiple expansion. Not necessarily, you haven't really earned it. You've just kind of been given it, kind of a subsidy from the Federal Reserve. It's created a tremendous amount of asset inflation. So what we do is we normalize cash flows and we use a required rate of return we believe is commensurate with the risk of a business. So we don't look at the risk-free rate. So when rates were at 0%, we weren't lowering our return objectives. We were trying to stay true to our discipline. And there just wasn't a lot to buy if you didn't use 0% rates as your guiding light. So you're in a period of quantitative easing. You're in a period of massive fiscal deficits. We talk about pro forma earnings if you didn't have $2 trillion fiscal deficits on a $27 trillion economy. I can guarantee you, if we balanced our budget, we would be in a serious recession, if not depression. I'm not saying that's the earnings you should use, but you shouldn't. I don't think you should be extrapolating these earnings today that are being goosed by federal spending. The government spending's gone up from $4 trillion to over $6 trillion, really over the past 4 years. I mean, it's amazing. So you had this emergency spending in COVID, but it never came back. It never really reverted back to where we were. And then you have the deficits, and everyone's like, geez, why are earnings holding up? It's such a mystery. The government's flooding the country with money and wealth, perceived wealth anyways. Home prices around here, we live in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida, three bedroom, two bath. I'm embarrassed to tell you what that would probably cost you. It's just the amount of perceived wealth from the asset inflation. And then you throw on fiscal deficits on top of that, and again, I think it's why earnings aren't rolling over? Why are we not having a soft landing? It's pretty self-evident. But see, our position is, and why we're not fully invested, is all of this is unsustainable. We're going to revert to means. We're not going to have 12% profit margins indefinitely. Historically, it's more like a 6 to 8 margin. So we are betting on the cyclicality of human behavior, the cyclicality of the economy, cyclicality of markets, eventually overwhelming all of this artificial interference. And if we're wrong, we joked earlier, I might start a pizza shop. And if we're right, I think we'll serve some people well, including ourselves. And that's why we launched. We launched in 2000, we launched a firm in 18, launched the fund in 19. But our whole objective is that absolute return. But it's also, this cycle has just been so insane from so many perspectives that we believe at the end of it, there will be a pot of gold. It, waiting has to pay off. There has to be a reward for this pain value investors are going through. And when that happens, just like 08, 09, it's so that when the bids disappear and there's all these values, you're a kid in a toy store. It's so much fun. But to do that, you've got to enter the store with some liquidity. You can't be fully invested. You can't be overpaying for quality, which is extremely expensive right now. But you gotta kind of look stupid at right now. I think that's probably our strategy, is to look maybe as dumb as possible when most people are looking like geniuses.
Eric, do you have any sense of, let's say, profit margins, I think peaked out at 13.3% there for S&P 500. If you were to normalize, let's take out a $1 trillion deficit that's just, kind of a sugar high, and take out really low interest rate costs, so interest expense for the S&P 500, where would margins be if we kind of normalize the deus ex machina version of, government intervention?
I mean, in aggregate, it's hard to say, because we look everything bottom up. But I would say, from a bottom up perspective, I would say, on average, within our opportunity set, I would think margins are probably 40 to 50% higher than they should be. And a lot of that, again, is the government spending the fiscal stimulus. But also, you've had, after COVID, there was a lot of supply chain issues. It was hard for people to find labor. And what a lot of the companies we follow have done is they are making less to make more, right? So they, because of COVID, they figured out, hey, we don't have to sell a ton of volume at a ton of price. We don't have to max out our factories, our facilities, our distribution. We can pull back and just raise our prices. And it's cool to lose volume, especially the low profitable things. So that had a really positive impact on margins. And kudos to a lot of the companies for figuring that out. You don't have to run at full capacity to make money. Ralph Lauren's a great example of many things, but one is they just started jacking up the prices over the past just 3 years, I would think. And margins have done very well. The stock's done well, profits are booming, but they've also had the tailwind of the wealthy. Apparel's not doing well right now, but Ralph Lauren is, and that's because of pricing and the affluent having so much money to buy really nice shirts and slacks, and not like the Amazon essentials I'm wearing right
You're a value guy at heart. I saw you had a discussion about quality in your blog post on WD-40, which a lot of people know because everybody's got a can of WD-40 everywhere in the world, I think. And they've done that brand extension where they stick it in everything else as well. So you can get your tea with
I was joking.
WD-40
I
in there.
said that, how are they going to grow? Are they going to start putting this in toothpaste?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's their plan.
Cologne.
And it was covered in that Greenwald book too. It was like that poster child in that Greenwald book for something that couldn't really grow, but like threw off a lot of cash flow. It
It's a great business for sure.
was an interesting analysis. You said that for most of its life, it's been reasonably valued, stayed between 15 to 20. And then since 2008, the PE's expanded quite a bit with nothing else. And there's no other change really in the business.
And I think the two major factors that we talked about in the blog post were it's almost a perfect correlation to QE. You monetize debt and peg rates at 0%, a perpetual bond type business will look really attractive. Now you don't demand a 8% free cash flow yield with rates at zero. Maybe 3% looks pretty good. And in fact, now it's a 2% earnings yield with rates at five. So that's not making a lot of sense right now, but that's a whole other topic. But then you have the passive funds too. The largest holders of this of the stock are passive funds. And that's almost also a perfect correlation to the AUM of the passive strategies or the funds that own it versus its multiple. So yeah, QE and passive there has been a very powerful combination for valuation.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about, like, WD-40's equity is basically like a 50-year bond. So of course, that much duration when you change interest rates is going to really move that the price of that.
Yeah, and a lot of the free cash flow is paid out as a dividend. So you're not really growing internally, or you really can't, as long as you're paying all that out, a lot
Yeah,
of it out. And
even more bond-like then.
right. And equity comp too. So yeah, it was interesting analogy or example, I guess, of what we're seeing with the quality. And those are the kind of companies we want to own. But you just a 2-3% earnings yield, really closer to 2 now. That just doesn't make sense, especially where rates are. Not that we use rates entirely, but you're just like, a few years ago, 0% rates were the reason you would buy, pay 50 times. But now with the rates at 5%, you're still buying it 50 times. So
Yeah, how
wait a
does that work? How does that
minute.
work?
Well, I think it's like a super inverted curve right now, right? Like,
Or inverted.
yeah, inverted. I mean,
Yeah, I
close
mean,
rates at five, the 10-year at whatever, what is it now, 2 or 3 or something, and then 50-year back at 2 or something.
yeah, but you think about a normalized multiple now for the S&P. Let's just say it's 33 times, or 3%, 3% versus 5% or 4%. You have a negative equity risk premium. At this stage of the cycle, when I talk, and I was a little reluctant to come on, I talked to Jake about this. Is I feel like I all sound crazy, but when you think about all the crazy things going on right now, the fiscal deficits, I mean, political, geopolitical, the profit margins, government spending, I mean, it just goes on and on. The threat of quantitative easing, and here's the crazy one: the Fed is going to. Is really threatening to cut rates right after they just lost 20% of our purchasing power. It's like, are you serious? I mean, this is how you rebuild your credibility while inflation now is starting to pick up. And there's a lot of reasons inflation is starting to stabilize and go back up, but we can talk about that. But so you have all these things that are just, insane. And then these value investors that preach discipline, patience, maybe now is the time to earn 5% instead of chasing a 2% free cash flow yield. We're the ones that are crazy. It's you have a negative risk equity risk premium right now with all of this going on, and the extrapolation of profits, which has never happened before. We never had a linear profit cycle perpetually. It's never happened. So you're betting on something that's never happened, and we're crazy. Maybe a little bit defensive.
I've talked about it a lot on this podcast, but I follow the yield curve. I haven't talked about it more recently because it's gone bananas. But the yield curve, the 10-year has sort of moved up and down. I don't know if it floats freely or how it's priced, but the short end of the curve, the 3 month, the 2 year, whichever one you prefer, that's the Fed pinning it up. The 3 month is higher now than it was 12 months ago, which is much, much higher than it was 12 months before that. All of the yield curve uninversion that happened last year, all of that normalization was the 10-year floating up, and then somebody got the cold spoon out, and that fell pretty quickly. It's been floating around. The thing that typically ends these yield curve inversions is the Fed getting spooked and pulling down the front end of it, and that just hasn't happened yet. It's higher now than it was this time last year, when it was already an old inversion, but now it's the longest yield curve inversion ever. At its steepest point, it was the steepest yield curve inversion ever. If this doesn't result in a recession, then you probably got to throw this out as an indicator. But it seems to me that this doesn't portend good things for the stock market when this sort of finally
Well,
normalizes.
it's just like the cyclicality of the economy and profits. It's hard to throw out those kind of things. They make too much sense. But I would say I think the Fed did get spooked when the longer term rates hit 5%, and that was October, November, December. And I remember at the time everyone was like, why are they pivoting? What's going on? And well, the cost of debt, is
Yeah, for the Fed,
5%
for
for
the
the
federal
government.
government. Is that what they're called?
So, fiscal spending on interest expense now is, as everyone knows, is a trillion. Well, that's double, from just a couple of years ago. So I think that 5% kind of freaked them out, and now with the kind of the threatening to cut rates, I think this is a strategy to help fund the deficits, but also to strongly encourage people to move out on the curve and buy debt because rates are falling. You better get out and buy, better buy them now. You know, even though we're issuing $2 trillion in debt more every year, they're going
The
fast.
so
Buy
won't
these
last forever.
bonds. Yeah.
Don't make me cut 4 times.
Is hard to imagine a scenario that's, barring just some absolute incredible Hail Mary technology advancement that lands, and maybe AI is that, I don't know, and robots and whatever, but where there's not just kind of continuous ingredients for inflation to be kind of persistent for quite a while. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned earlier some of the things that are reversing, you know, that we're seeing with our companies from the bottom up. There was a tremendous amount of inventory destocking last year, and that's run its course. So you're not going to need the amount of promotions and inventory. You don't have to dump your inventory. And what that also did when people are reducing their inventories, well, one, also they're doing that to generate cash, which was very effective. But they reduced freight. You know, trucking prices collapsed because everyone was destocking their inventory. That's over. There's a lot of excess capacity coming out of the trucking industry right now because these rates don't make sense. And of course, you have gas prices going back up. So that was a huge tailwind for a lot of companies and for inflation on the goods inflation. So that is going to go away second half of this year. And obviously, you had very easy comparisons. Against year-over-year inflation, you know, the Fed's getting a lot of credit for reducing inflation, but in reality, it's because they did such a poor job over, you know, from 22 to 23 that now inflation comparably looks, you know, oh, great job. It's like my kid's getting an F, and then they get a D, and they say, wow, you know, the D is a lot better than F, you know.
That's
But so when
good
you have
inflation.
9% inflation, yeah, the next year makes it a lot easier. You know, if you do really bad with inflation, which they've done, they've destroyed 20% of our purchasing power. You know, now all of a sudden this is good. You know, 4% inflation. That's nice. But let's again not forget that go try to buy a house right now. You know, pay your
Yeah.
auto insurance bill. I mean, there are so many things in our life, anyways. That when I pay the bills, I mean, it's like instinct now in my head. I just have this inflation called the inflation head shake. I'm like, oh my gosh. And then I say, are you go to Panera Bread and buy a sandwich with your kid and you leave and you feel like you need to take a home equity line out. You know, it's so they can celebrate this inflation victory all they want. The reality is the middle class and the lower class have been absolutely destroyed. They're under a tremendous amount of pressure. I've got one example and I'll stop because I know I'm talking too much, but we have a company, Monroe. They do auto repair. And, you know, they came out with their last earnings call. They're talking about customers, instead of buying 4 tires, they're buying 2 tires. And the customers that are buying 2 tires, historically have been buying two tires, are now buying 1 tire. So
Jeez.
you have this large percentage of the population that is debating whether to replace 2 tires or 1 tire, you know, and that's probably half the population that hasn't participated in this massive asset inflation. And we have this so-called balanced economy. In reality, what it is half the economy is booming. People are just crushing it. Money's coming out of their ears. And the other half are just been devastated by all this inflation. And for us to start cutting rates now, while asset prices are at record highs, home prices are at record highs, and to somehow justify this and say, you know, we're going to have a soft landing, you're just going to keep empowering the rich and keep, you know, hurting the poor. So I think we're in a moment where asset inflation is not the answer. But that's where we're going, you know. And we could have a melt-up here. I mean, we don't know. But you're cutting rates and threatening to slow down QT in an environment that feels, you know, almost like 1999. You know? So it's to me again, it goes back to, you know, I'm crazy. You know? And this environment is just nuts.
Speaking of 1999, I don't know if you guys follow this closely, but Reddit, you guys know what Reddit is? Reddit, the website, has gone public. Ticker's RDDT. Its stock is up 35% since it listed, and it came out. It was rich when it went out. I didn't do a DCF on it because the bottom line is a negative number, which I find it's kind of hard for me to imagine how that is the case because they have this website where they just have all of these people who contribute to it for free. So they've like their cost of creating the product is virtually nil and somehow it doesn't make money. But in any case, it's up 35%. That's perfect for this environment.
I take it it's no longer small cap.
It's 11.5 billion. What's your definition of small cap? I think it came out at eight. You probably could have snuck it in there.
So we actually have a very wide definition, 100 million to 10 billion. So we want to keep as many opportunities as possible. So I'll have to get that symbol from you again.
You have to take your analyst and slap him around a little bit because it came out at eight and it would have exited at 10, would have been perfect. You could have just had that little 25% trade there.
Well, back in the old days, when I worked in New York, you actually would I would go to I was in my early mid 20s. I was in my mid 20s, and I would go to these road shows. I was always volunteer because IPO launches in New York were just like five stars, incredible. And I was this broke 25-year-old kid, and I would sit in this table with management, and I would be eating, and I would be focused on the food. It's just like, I can't believe this. This is unbelievable.
Just eating
And
shrimp.
then I would go back and tell the portfolio manager, yeah, buy some. Because it always went up. The IPOs always go up. You get allocated a certain amount of shares, and then they would sell them the next day to kind of flip them, make a profit. But the IPOs, I mean, if you're an analyst on the buy side or sell side and you get to go to one of those lunch or dinners, strongly recommend that.
You don't want to hold it for too long. Check out all those IPOs from a few
No,
years ago.
it's a day
They're all
trade.
down a touch.
You want to definitely flip it. You don't want to hold those.
Those are
Take
trading sardines.
your lunch and your 30%. Eric,
It's late, but
and
let me give a quick shout out
oh
before.
yeah,
Sorry,
go for it, TC.
JT, just before I cut you off.
Yeah, go ahead.
Toronto is at Teslaville. What's up? Speaking of which, down a little bit. Nashville, Valparaiso, what's up? Port Arthur, Texas, Perth, WA, 1:32 a.m. That's strong. Durham, Jupiter, congrats. New Delhi, Snohomish County, Salem, Cromwell, New Zealand, good to have you. Old Ocean, Texas, Brandon, Mississippi, Istanbul, Turkey, Lausanne, Switzerland, winning. Mendocino, Helsinki, Hong Kong.
My God, it's
Leuven,
worldwide.
Belgium, Las Vegas in the house. Sorry, JT. Après-vous.
I was just going to say that some of my favorite work that Eric does is bottom up. He's a one of the best bottom up economists. So looking at the companies, reading all their transcripts and earnings calls, and actually ferreting out like what is happening from the bottom upwards, rather than kind of all the economists tend to be more top down, it feels like. But Eric, maybe you could share some of the interesting findings that you've been noticing lately on the last update that you did for that.
Yeah, and the reason we do that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something I think it's a little different. A lot of bottom up analysts and managers, they don't have a macro view. But because we normalize earnings in our valuations, it's very important for us to understand where we are on the profit cycle, whether you're peak or trough. Like 2009, you're in the trough. You don't want to use those earnings to value a company because they're too low. And then, I would argue currently margins are so high, you probably don't want to use these margins either to value a company. So we do is we have a possible buy list of about 300 names, and every quarter, we read the releases and conference calls, and come up with our macro view. And it's a couple pages, kind of a summary of our highlights, and it's a little over 100 pages of notes. But it's kind of interesting because I think one of the things we picked up on pretty quickly in 2021 was inflation, because we were seeing it with all of our companies, but you weren't seeing it yet in the government data. So there's things like that I think we can pick up on. In fact, I wrote a blog post called "Buy Things." And my whole theory was the companies are clearly communicating price increases, and go out buy some appliances and.
Yeah, get out in front of
I
that.
bought like 3 years worth of weeding feed, and I think I made like 30% on that. So you can see a lot of things through the bottom up that you can't really see in government data, which is often seasonally adjusted, massaged, and usually it's revised and it's dated. So Things we're seeing right now, we touched on sort of the two economies, economy one, economy two, one doing great, one doing awful. I would think that's the biggest theme right now of sort of the disparity so large. And then going to the fiscal side, a lot of cyclical companies tied to the economy, manufacturing, construction, actually doing quite well. But you have a lot of spending on, whether it's data centers, semiconductor plants, infrastructure across the board, roads and bridges. We had an asphalt company, Gencor Industries, we owned for a while, did very well. But that was just the government flooding the system with money to pave roads. So that's done well. Transportation's been weak. But I think that's going to change. I think that's going to pick up. Energy's been pretty good. Natural gas has been awful, but oil's done so well for these companies. That's quite a bit higher than cost, that they're doing well. Services, energy services lag. The E&Ps, just because E&Ps have had so much more pricing discipline this cycle. Another theme that is very important that we're seeing is companies, small cap companies with debt, the maturity walls are getting really, they're getting a little uncomfortable. So some of these smaller cap companies, they're not like, McDonald's, which has a lot of debt, but they can still go out and issue debt and not, there's no issue. But these smaller companies with debt, with maturity walls approaching, if you even bring up like, hey, I might need capital, the stock's going to get destroyed. So I think one of the things the market, I don't think markets are particularly efficient right now. But one thing I think they have done a good job with is smaller cap companies with debt when the maturity wall's approaching, those stocks are down. So if you're going to take risk right now, and the company really well, and you think they'll survive the next recession or credit crunch, I think financial risk is probably where I would look. Fortunately, we don't have to be fully invested, so we don't have to buy a highly levered company to try to stay invested. But that's kind of interesting right now, what we're seeing from the bottom up.
I had a look
Interesting.
at the Yardeni site where he splits out the PE. It's a great website if anybody's looking for a whole lot of charts to stick into stuff, but he splits out the PE multiples of large cap, mid cap, and small cap. And one thing that really stood out to me is that large cap PE multiples have mostly expanded, but mid cap and small cap have definitely been contracting. And I just wondered if that was the reason that you're identifying that the small and mid cap have a lot more
Yes.
trouble rolling
Yes.
their debt. Like,
And well,
but
the market has done a better job in small caps because you don't have the flows you get the S&P, and the QQQs, especially like foreign investors are usually not buying the small caps, or they're just piling money into the larger mega caps. But still, I'm not saying small caps are cheap, but I would say in certain areas, I think the market's done a little better job of penalizing companies that may have taking on too much debt through buybacks or acquisitions, and they're not giving them a second chance. And if you ask for debt, your stock's going to get killed. So I do think that's true. But the makeup of small caps is a little different too. There's the money losing companies, which haven't done well at all. And the S&P for the most part is profitable companies. Same with mainly the larger caps in general are usually companies that make money. But small caps are 40% money losers. So the market's probably done a better job of beating those up. If you look at just profitable small caps and maybe mid caps, I don't know, it's a little different picture where the valuations are quite a bit higher than they were. I did a post that said this is not 1999. In 1999, well, not from a large cap perspective, I mean, not from a small cap perspective, 90 is looking a lot like 99 from a large cap technology perspective. But in 99, you could buy, WD-40 probably in the mid to low teens multiple, but now it's 50 times. But there was a plethora of small cap, high quality small caps you could buy 15, 10 times earnings, dirt cheap. So, but now those same companies, are twice, three times the valuation. So quality's done very well in small caps. And that goes back to profitable companies and quality have done a lot of well, done very well. And I think the reason for that is, when things are expensive, a lot of professional investors, especially, they need to participate so they don't lose assets. And I think they feel if I buy quality, maybe I'm not, I'm kind of cheating, but not really. At least I'm buying some good stuff. I remember this manager that used to just say in his presentations, he would just go franchise, and like that is like you're forgiven. It doesn't matter
Classics.
what you pay, as long as you said franchise, it's all good. So I think a
On
lot of
purpose.
people are chasing franchise businesses now, feeling safe from the business perspective, but in reality, I think they're taking a tremendous amount of valuation risk, which of course the price you pay is usually the biggest determinant of how you do.
Yeah, there's a pretty common refrain of you want to own quality into a recession, right? And that but if everybody sort of arrives at that conclusion, it
Yes.
gets priced in, and now is that actually smart to do? Kind of maybe a little bit more of a question mark.
Yep. And you don't want to buy highly levered cyclical companies into a recession. But I think in small caps, anyways, they've sniffed that out already. And maybe if you had to be invested now, maybe that is you want. Maybe you do want to buy a cyclical. You want to take operating risk or financial risk going into a recession, which is weird or different. But just where prices are, maybe that does make more sense.
Do you find any industries or sectors interesting? Are you allowed to name names, or do you name names?
The things we've been buying and own or have owned, we have been selling some into this market melt up over the last few months, but they've been very smaller industries that you just don't think of. We talked about Gencor, the asphalt plant equipment. They own 40% of the market share in asphalt plants. So they're the market leader, but it's like a 250 million market cap. And then we own the market leader in tow trucks, right? We own an insurance adjuster. We own a company in Canada that made fruit snacks and juice. Some of these are not big industries or ones you really classified, excluding the food company. They're just unique industries, smaller, that even if they own 100% of the market, they would never be a mid-cap stock.
One of the things that stood out to me from the Yardeni chart that I mentioned a little while ago was that for most of the last, I forget how far it goes back, but it's at least 20 years, something like that. For most of the last 20 years, mid cap and small cap have traded at a premium, a PE multiple premium to large cap. And it's only since the pandemic that the large cap's PE multiple has expanded beyond. I don't know if that's ordinarily the case or not. I just can't remember, but it just seemed odd to me that since the pandemic, it's flipped in any case. And I don't know. I guess the argument could be that before then, you want the faster growing stuff, mid cap, small cap grows faster, so therefore the PE should be higher. Post pandemic, large caps are safer financially, so therefore you pay a higher price for that. But I don't know. Do you have any, given you're a small cap guy, do you have any view on either of those thoughts?
Well, it's tough to use small cap valuations in aggregate because there's so many things that affect the multiple. We talked about money losing companies about 40%. And then, like the Russell 2000 value, huge portion of that is financials. And you look at those multiples, they're very low. And I don't think they're the real multiples. Like, I don't think those are the real earnings. If you mark to market for instance, the commercial real estate loans or any of the longer dated loans, the ones that are kind of not
Held
using
to
the market.
maturity.
Yes. So that actually skews the small cap multiple down considerably. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of small cap banks that might be insolvent right now if you use mark to market. So you got to be careful with that. And energy too, right now, a lot of multiples are low because of where oil prices are. So, it's so hard to, we get that a lot, because some of the multiples look reasonable. If you pull everything out, you pull out the money losers, and leave in the banks and leave in some of these cyclicals that are doing well. But if you normalize on a bottom up basis, the picture looks very different. So we always want to caution people to be careful with these aggregate multiples. And, sometimes people will give you multiples on like fact sheets and whatnot, and they won't even explain how they derived it, because if you exclude a lot of things, you can make any benchmark look interesting, or portfolio.
I always thought it was funny how the Russell does that calculation. They exclude all of the things that are non-earners, and then they truncate the really high PEs. So the PE is just, it's a bizarre kind of calculation.
That's right. We Jamie's done a lot of work on that because we get asked a lot of a lot by clients, if multiples are here, like someone told us small caps are 14 times earnings, anything on a normalized basis, we're not seeing anywhere near that. So we would recommend being careful on aggregate valuations.
How do
I
you
would
normal?
answer.
Sorry, Jesse.
I was just going to answer the question about that kind of inversion of multiple between small and large. And I mean, the charitable version would be, in my mind, returns on scale and technology companies like making tons of money and that whole thesis playing out and maybe some truth to it. My less charitable, grinchy version would be like probably the bigger the company, the closer you are to the trough of money pouring out, right? Cantillion effects of and you get the money before it trickles down to a smaller company, right? So your margins look better. Everyone, you get the revenue before the cost inflation shows up as much. So of course then you look more profitable.
I would say too, I think, and those are good points. The equity comp for larger companies is quite a bit larger than many of the companies we follow. So, and then that often gets excluded from earnings. So again,
The
there's a lot of
SBC.
exclusion, a lot of exclusions out there that you have to be careful of.
Microsoft 11 billion a year, I saw on a quarterly run rate basis.
Why aren't we? Why are we on? We should
Yeah,
be
we
trying to
made a
get a job at
mistake
Microsoft.
there.
What are we doing?
Right.
That doesn't show up in earnings, but it shows up in cash flow when you buy back the stock. So, I mean, I know you guys know that.
Yeah, and some of those tech companies, the SBC as a percentage of free cash flow is extreme. I mean, 20
Yes.
is like kind of a considered a gold standard, and there's lots of
Yeah.
companies that are north of 100%.
Yeah. And that goes back to multiples. I mean, most analysts will just. They'll go past all of the things that are said to be one time that occur almost every time, and then they go right to the adjusted earnings and they slap a multiple on that and they go to lunch.
2027 adjusted earnings.
Yeah.
How
Let the
does
good
this
times
all
roll.
play out, Eric? We've got an election this year, which is presumably why there's so much fiscal stimulus around. I think the Fed to some extent has been counteracting that, although they seem like they're, as you say, they're threatening to drop rates all the time, which seems to have helped keep everything elevated. Six rate cuts this year. There's now we're through a few of the meetings, so now it's three rate cuts this year or something like that. But what do you think? How does this play out?
That's why I came on, Toby. I thought you were going
Yeah.
I don't know. I've given up. I think I just say the market's going to go down 50% at some point in the future, at which point returns will be really good. But that's my evergreen prediction. That's always true.
I'm going to go with that. What you said sounds great.
I did see that there was a guy who changed his legal name to
Yeah.
anybody else. That's his name.
Literally anyone else.
And he's running for president. And
He's going to
so,
win. That guy's
yeah,
going
if
to
you could,
win. He wins.
what if we had a new third party that's became just from the votes of literally anybody else?
The funny thing about that guy is he's 35 and like 1 week or something. Like he waited until right. This is the very first time he can run.
I tell you though, I mean, one thing about where we are right now is I'm baffled by this. We have to cut rates right here. It doesn't make sense. So it does make you wonder if it is political. And if it is political, does this backfire? Because if it's political and it sort of tilts for the Democrats, well, half of the population doesn't own stocks. A lot of their voters don't own homes. And now you're going to put them further behind the wealthy? I mean, maybe they're going to be upset by
The
this.
way that backfires
Do you think
is
they care when the QQQ goes up a percent every day? I mean,
Bastille Day.
yeah, I think this could backfire on them if it is political.
Everybody gets a shave.
And there's so many things that could happen that cause this cycle to end. But one that doesn't get a lot of talk is the social or the wealth inequality. It is, I mean, when we just pay our bills and things, I just wonder, how in the world can people afford to live right now? So that is just making that worse to me doesn't, it's not only not the solution, which is the way they're going, I think it's just going to get build a bigger and bigger issue down the road. It's just, of all things, not sustainable, having half the population do very well and really just crushing the other half. It just doesn't seem sustainable to me, but it has been going on for probably longer than I expected, so
Well,
could be
unemployment's
wrong
at
on that.
close to all-time lows, stock markets at all-time highs, real estate
Yeah.
markets
You
very
can't, I mean,
expensive.
housing affordability, right? I mean, it is our first house, I think, was $250,000, and I thought we were overpaying. Not
You can never overpay in real estate. Like,
in
unless
Florida,
it's
apparently.
2006.
Yeah. Well, that actually was 2004, and then our house went up to 400,000. I couldn't believe it. We sold, and then we rented for 2 years, waited for the bust. And then we bought, so we actually day traded the home for 2 years. But so that worked out really well. And then I'm like, well, do we do it now? Because now our house is worth a stupid amount again, for no reason except, asset inflation. But the difference today is, it's, well, we have kids now, so it makes it a lot harder. But the cost to rent is significantly higher. So that renting
Yeah.
equation doesn't work as well, or that variable. And I feel this cycle, I want to have a part of our cost of living locked in. Like, I don't trust the Fed. In 06, 07, or 06 when we sold, I didn't, QE wasn't a thing. I think if you sell and rent now, you're taking more risk in that the next recession or crisis, they print another 5 trillion. And now you're in an apartment, with kids and your wife, and they're like, "What's up?" Right?
Yeah,
Right?
I thought we were
Now
going to
you're
be in a
completely,
mansion by now.
yeah, you're priced out. I wish we were in our house. So it's a lot trickier. It's tempting for sure to take those gains, but everything is so expensive now. It's hard. The arbitrage is a lot different now than it was in 05, 06. In 06, you could sell your house and rent and take the proceeds and put it in a 5% CD, and it almost paid for your rent. It was wonderful. You can't do that now because rents are so high.
Probably,
I think,
shall we get some
let's
veggies
do the
under the
veggies.
wire
Yeah,
before
let's
too
do the
late?
veggies.
I try when I'm at my best to match up the veggies along with the guest. And as I mentioned before, that Eric is, to me, one of the great bottom-up economists out there, coming through all these earnings transcripts and then offering these kind of real-time insights that happen before they show up in official statistics. But it kind of got me thinking about this other fellow who made predictions about what it would be like if we could measure everything. And his name was Pierre-Simon Laplace. And he was a French scholar and polymath, and he lived from 1749 to 1827. And he made important contributions to engineering, mathematics, statistics, physics, astronomy. He has his name on a few equations, which is always about as big as it gets, right? If you can get your name on something. One of them is in the field of like partial differential equations. Don't ask me to tell you what that is. But apparently they use it for describing like tidal flows. And he was also the first to predict the existence of black holes. And 1814, he set out a mathematical system of inductive reasoning that's based on probability, which today we would probably recognize as like Bayesian statistics. So anyway, today we're going to be discussing this thought experiment that he had called Laplace's Demon. And it's an exercise in kind of causal determination. And it goes as follows. Imagine that there's a demon which knows the precise location and momentum of every atom in the universe and their past and future values for any given time. It could then be calculated and predicted with perfect accuracy. So basically, and by the way, Laplace never used the term demon in any of his writing. It was just added later for embellishment by others. But what if you could measure every single little absolute detail, and then could you accurately predict the future at that point? And this is, I think, kind of an interesting thing to think about AI then. And as we're trying to measure everything using AI, can AI do predictions that are better than, can it measure every little atom in the universe effectively? Now there are four arguments in against Laplace's demon in the physics realm. Number one is entropy. Laplace's demon was basically vanquished with the discovery of irreversibility and entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. Like, it's based on the premise that there is reversibility, but many thermodynamic processes are irreversible. So imagine like you stir a cup of coffee with cream in it, like you can't really you can't get the cream to be unstirred ever at that point. There's also the problem of quantum indeterminacy, and like this is basically like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. There's properties like position and momentum, which you can't know both at the same time. And then there's chaos theory and like the sensitivity to initial starting conditions. So, this is kind of like the classic butterfly effect, where small changes produce these huge inaccuracies in predictions. This one's a little bit less convincing because the premise of Laplace's demon is that you know every initial condition with perfect accuracy. And then the last one is computational complexity. There was recently some work that had a proposed limit on the computational power of the universe. So, and this is imagine the limit is based on like the maximum entropy of the universe using the speed of light, the minimum amount of time taken for information to move across the Planck length, and it's been shown to be about 10 to 120 power bits. So basically, like there's so much. It would require so much computational power to ever figure this out that like the amount of time that's elapsed in the last, since the universe started is not enough to ever really do it. So, but let's think a little bit about Laplace's demon and AI, because it's kind of an interesting topic right now. AI has the same problems of trying to predict outcomes based on data, like what is known today, what is going to happen tomorrow. And in this context, like it's kind of a useful metaphor. The AI is trying to predict future events, and if it had complete information, maybe it could, but it's never going to have. There's always fundamental limits to how much information you can actually have, and AI faces that same type of constraint. There's also the quality and the quantity of data that the AI is trained on. So, in that way, that sort of mirrors the impossibility of Laplace's demon having complete knowledge. And then there's some like ethical considerations, actually. Just like Laplace's demon raises questions about it, really like free will around, judicial sentencing, loan approvals, recruitment. Like, if you're using AI for some of these things, like there are these biases that can be baked into the AI based on the training data. If an AI is that good at predicting individual human behavior, like what does that imply then sort of for like personal responsibility and free will? And then the last one is kind of omniscience and control. The idea that if an entity could predict every future event, what kind of surveillance then would be required? Like you almost start to run into like Minority Report, the sci-fi movie with Tom Cruise, that predicting murders and things like that. So what does that mean then for privacy and autonomy and control of government? So hopefully there's a little bit of maybe thinking through some of Laplace's demons and the implications of that from a physics context that we can then apply to AI to help us give us some kind of metaphorical framework to explore the capabilities and limitations of AI.
What about natural intelligence? Does that suffer from those same limitations? More so.
Of course,
It's
yes, of course.
more inconsistent.
True.
On the ethical side, this is or timely. My daughter's English class had a essay assignment, and they discovered half of the students used AI to write it.
How did
Yeah.
they discover it?
And the teachers now are using AI to find AI. And so, this is going to be an issue for the academic world, because half the class decided it was a lot easier to have AI write the essay, and the other half did it. So that's just one example, but there's going to be a lot of ethical issues.
How do we pivot back to investing, JT? You'll land a plane.
Oh boy. I guess, Eric, if do you think that if how well do you think a model could do if you gave it all of the data that you collect on a bottom-up basis from these individual companies? Do you think that there's more insights to be gleaned from there, or would it start tipping into absurdities?
I have trouble thinking a computer can accurately predict the cyclicality of these businesses. I mean, there's so many variables that can affect margins, and they all move different ways at different times. And a lot of it's based on human behavior. So I'm too reluctant to feel confident of a valuation spit out by an AI model. Kind of the in the data going in, is that accurate? Is it smooth? Is it, we talked about the multiples being kind of, not really accurate in some cases. So when you look at an operating margin of a business every quarter, there's just so many things that can make it go one way or the other that are, I don't know. Maybe we do need AI because my mind is having a hard time comprehending this.
Do you find it helpful for hunting for ideas to kind of look through? Is that why you do it, to look through industries and look through them at that level? Just you're looking for, something that might be depressed but showing signs of life?
Yeah,
Or is it to help normalize for the companies that you're modeling?
it's more for normalized, but we follow a lot of the same companies, that we followed 20 years ago. So there's only so many mature market leaders and small caps, and that hasn't changed over many years. So if like oh, I hate using it. I always use this, but I'm using it anyways. Oildry is the market leader in cat litter, one of the market leaders, and it was founded in the 60s. I'm very confident it will be the market leader, one of the market leaders in 10 years from now. I'm very confident many of the variables that drive its the earnings will be around, be similar. So for us, a lot of it too is familiarity. We have 300 names, we know them well. So we follow the same ones. And some get bought out, and a name will come on the list, a name will come off. But over time, just following the same things, knowing something really well, I think provides a really good advantage. Because when COVID hit, and small caps fell 40%, we didn't have to do screens. It was immediate. We had ideas, we were buying immediately. And because we had familiarity with the names, we knew it was affecting margins, and we had a good idea what normalized were. So yeah, I don't know if AI can recreate that. I mean, if it could, I guess we're
Well, or
done.
maybe AI would allow you to keep a larger inventory of ideas on the shelf then.
Yeah, or it could alert you to, hey, this is trading below normalized, or the profits are above normalized, profits are below, and it could maybe help you with your screening. Where should I look? I think that might it might be more useful that way for us over time, but that's going to be tough, for us to transit, or at least for me, because how
One of
I've
the
done things for 30 years, I admit that would be hard.
criticisms of the small cap indexes has been that there's a deterioration in the quality of small caps because, for a variety of reasons. One, it's more costly to be listed, so some companies just stay private, stay with private equity, get handed back and forth between private equity. And other companies are like Facebook, they wait until they're huge before they come on the boards, maybe even Reddit, like it comes on at 8 billion. Where previously they might have listed as smaller companies and worked their way through those indexes and graduated into mid cap or large cap indexes. Have you found that? Is that your experience or something else?
Yeah, I think I've been doing this since 1993, and I definitely think the quality has declined. You can see that with the percentage of companies that lose money, but that's somewhat cyclical. I mean, here we are, in a booming kind of profit environment, and you still have 40% of companies losing money, so in a
Is that because
recession, it's usually,
they've never made money? They raise capital and they burn it.
And I mean, the last IPO boom we had, a lot of them were SPACs, right? I
Yeah.
mean, so those weren't, not
SPACs are
only
back.
they weren't making or losing money, they just were given money, so that was odd. But we usually don't buy a lot of IPOs because we buy more mature businesses that have been around a long time. We have a long operating history, but some of these IPOs do, but by now, if you're a market leader, mature business, you've probably already gotten bought out. There's not a lot left ready to go. That kind of business that are ready to go public. Like you said, there's a lot of reason now. Probably it's not worth it, especially if you don't need capital. And if you need capital, that's usually not the type of company we're interested in.
Eric, we're coming up on time. If folks want to follow along with what you're doing and get in touch, how do they do that?
PalmValleyCapital.com is our website, and we have a blog, and every quarter Jamie writes our letters, which are very good. And come to our website, and if you like our content, that's awesome. And if not, we understand. A little different. But we appreciate your interest and your time, guys. Jake and Toby, really appreciate you having me on.
I'll put in a plug that Eric's blog is one of the very few blogs that I read regularly. I pretty much anytime he puts something, I'll read it within 20 minutes.
Jake, that's because it's under 1,000 words, right?
That's because that's not a bad thing.
doesn't hurt. Yeah.
Eric Cinnamon, thank you very much, folks. We'll be back next week. Same bat channel, same bat time. See you.